Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The cockroach theory of finance goes something like this. You see one piece of bad news, you know there must be more hiding in the walls. Banks have been dribbling out the bad news about their exposure to the subprime mess for months, and it's time to turn the lights on again. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you with us on this Monday. It is the 14th day of January. It's a big week for earnings reports out of the banking sector, and no one is expecting it to be pretty. Two big ones, M&T Bank Corp and Sovereign Bank, warned today that the subprime mess and credit crunch will hurt their results. Citigroup announces earnings tomorrow, and CNBC is reporting that the country's largest bank will announce a $24 billion write-down and up to 24,000 layoffs. That write-down is more than twice what Citigroup previously announced. Ashley Milne-Tite asks why the company didn't know just how bad things would be.
As to whether Citigroup is reeling with shock at the extent of its subprime losses, that depends who you ask. Bart Natter is with consulting firm Celent.
I think they did not expect things to get as bad as they have turned out to be.
Natter says Citi isn't the only bank to be surprised. Bank of America plowed $2 billion into Countrywide Financial in August. It expected Countrywide to improve, but last week it had to buy the lender to save it from bankruptcy.
If Bank of America, who is the number six mortgage originator in the country, can make that kind of a mistake, it's not difficult for me to imagine that Citi could make that kind of mistake as well.
Not everyone believes the banks are that naive. Christopher Whalen is managing director of Institutional Risk Analytics. He says the banks bought mortgage-related securities knowing they might not be able to trade them as easily as a share or a bond.
So the market value was always relative, much like any illiquid security. But on the other hand, they have devoted so much time and money and manpower to growing this market that I don't think they could admit that the whole thing was imploding, because that's what's happening.
Whalen says investors will want Citi to be completely upfront about its losses tomorrow. Bert Ely is a banking consultant. He says Citi might end up overstating the damage.
My sense is that the banking firms and their accountants are going to want to err on the conservative side. Far better to overestimate the losses than underestimate them.
Ely says it'll be at least another year before banks and investors find out precisely how much havoc subprime has wrought. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Remember the 9,000 earmarks in the spending bill the president signed last month? Well, there are rumblings in Washington today that he wants another crack at them. Here's how insiders think it would go. The president would issue an executive order to eliminate the earmarks and then send the money elsewhere, somewhere popular, like bridge repair or children's health care. But can he do it? Jeremy Hobson has that story from Washington.
The short answer is, for most earmarks, yes, he can. The reason is right in his last State of the Union address.
You didn't vote him into law? I didn't sign him into law.
That's true. Most earmarks are in what's called a conference report. It's not actually part of the bill that passed, says James Thurber, a constitutional scholar at American University.
The executive branch does not have to go along with what is stated in the conference report. The conference report, of course, puts detail on what the House and the Senate agree to. It's not actually part of the law.
So why don't appropriators make all earmarks law? Well, it takes longer, for one, and lawmakers assume federal agencies wouldn't dare ignore earmarks and upset the very people who control the purse strings. Of course, the president would be going up against more than just congressional Democrats if he removed all the earmarks.
Earmarks are a bipartisan affliction. There are members of both parties that are very quick to feed at the trough.
Steve Ellis is with the watchdog group Taxpayers for Common Sense. He says besides a few budget hawks in Congress, the president would face overwhelming bipartisan opposition. But in the face of mounting economic concerns across the board,
it would really resonate well with the public and would go a little ways to restoring some of the fiscal responsibility mantle that the president has shredded over his previous 6 years.
In other words, if he does do it, it's all about legacy. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
So Congress and the president both sign a bill and then part of it just doesn't count? Isn't that kind of like Randy and Paula and Simon agreeing that somebody's a good singer and then Simon deciding he doesn't like a singer's hairdo, so well, she can't be on the show? Okay, maybe they're not quite the same. But anyway, for those of you, us, who've spent the last several months practicing the insults you'll hurl at the television, it's back.
American Idol returns Tuesday, January 15th on Fox.
Yes, American Idol is back tomorrow night, and its 30 bazillion viewers are rejoicing. Almost as much as advertisers are. We begged Marketplace's Lisa Napoli to sing this next story. She politely declined.
Advertisers were already ponying up 30% more cash than last year for commercials on this upcoming round of American Idol. But now that they're desperate to reach a strike-weary television audience, word is the charge for a 30-second spot on the show is zoomed up to $1 million per, more than any other TV series out there.
Idol right now is a great place to be for anyone whose product needs to be advertised on television.
That's Michael Berge, editor-in-chief of Media Week. He says previous talk of Idol fatigue is going by the wayside now that there's nothing much new to watch on TV.
It's going to deliver a huge audience from the get-go. Even if it's 10% lower than last year, that's going to be way larger than anything remotely approximating it on television right now.
And Idol's enormous 18 to 49-year-old audience already had a great reputation with advertisers. Media analyst Jack Myers says that's because viewers actually watch the ads.
American Idol gets a higher commercial playback than many other programs for those people who do pre-record. It's viewed heavily live. Commercials aren't skipped as much in American Idol.
Meyer says even though advertisers are paying a premium to get their messages out on the show, they feel it's a cost-effective bang for the buck. No matter who wins the latest Idol competition, the biggest winner of all will be the TV network that carries it, Fox. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Wall Street's been singing the blues of late, but not today, thanks to Big Blue. Details when we do the numbers. Former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan is scheduled to arrive in Kenya tomorrow in an effort to kickstart negotiations over a disputed presidential election there. Violence since the December 27th election has claimed more than 600 lives, according to official estimates. But one Kenyan minister today rejected Annan's planned visit, saying, "We don't have a problem here." Over the weekend, the Bush administration warned that the U.S. cannot conduct business as usual in Kenya until the two sides agree to talk. Meanwhile, other problems are cropping up around the country, and with us to talk about them from Nairobi is reporter Sarah Nix. And Sarah, I understand you personally experienced some of the unrest that's been going on there. Can you tell us about your trip with the Red Cross?
I went with the Kenyan Red Cross into Korogocho, which is one of the poorest and kind of most notorious slums on the east side of Nairobi. So we took three truckloads of food to about 2,000 people. It was amazing, really, the number of people who showed up, women, children, old men, old women, women with babies. They handed food out to about 20 people before the whole situation just disintegrated. A group of young men stormed the back of the trucks, and the aid workers and myself, we had to flee. It took tear gas and gunshots in the air to get us out of there, quite frankly.
Is there a food shortage, or is this a matter of not being able to get the food where it needs to go?
I don't think that there's a food shortage in this country. What it is it's just not safe for many drivers to be on the roads right now. Goods aren't getting around the country. That means food's coming into the port in Mombasa, food is being grown all around the country. But it's not safe, say, for a member of a tribe from Western Kenya to drive through the central province on the way to Nairobi. Just today I heard two stories of public buses and even school buses being stoned by mobs on the roads in Kenya. So with good reason, perhaps, some drivers are refusing to do their jobs, refusing to transport goods. There's also the issue of increased food prices. You know, when we were driving into Korogocho on Friday, I was keeping my eye on the food stands, and most of them were largely empty. And from what I hear, the food that are on those stands, the prices have gone up substantially. I know in my neighborhood, somebody tried to charge me 10 shillings for a banana that usually cost me 5. Wow. I heard that in the slums, cabbages that normally go for 10 shillings are now going for 70.
Well, if they're having trouble transporting food around the country, then I assume that folks are also having trouble getting to work.
Absolutely, absolutely. There are still people, almost 3 weeks now since the election, there are still people who are marooned in their rural homes, who can't get into Nairobi or Kisumu or wherever their places of work are. And also, people in the slums are marginally employed at best. And because of the unrest in Nairobi and in other parts of the country, they aren't able to get to whatever employment they're able to get.
Is there any speculation about when things might settle down there?
I wish I had a good answer for you about that. People here are tired. They're tired of this violence. They don't see it as part of the identity of Kenya. They understand that continuing economic development and peace are really the road to better lives for everybody here. That said, people are really frustrated that in the minds of many Kenyans, their democratic right was undermined by vote rigging. And the violence that followed that has kind of unveiled all of this suppressed tribalism.
Sarah, thank you for joining us, and stay safe.
Thank you.
And Sarah's been writing a blog during her time in Nairobi. We've got a link to it on our website. It's marketplace.org. Today, the social networking company MySpace announced plans to beef up protections for minors who use the site. MySpace is owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation. As part of a deal with 49 state attorneys general, it promised to change its structure to better protect young users from online predators. Similar changes will be encouraged for other sites like Facebook. Both social networking companies are big players in the new economy. Commentator Nicholas Carr says it's too bad they don't employ very many people.
There's a new breed of internet company on the loose. They grow like weeds, serve millions of customers a day, and operate globally. And they have very, very few employees. Look at YouTube, the video network. When it was bought by Google in 2006 for more than $1 billion, it was one of the most popular and fastest-growing sites on the net, broadcasting more than 100 million clips a day. Yet, it employed a grand total of 60 people. Compare that to a traditional TV network like CBS, which has more than 23,000 employees. Or look at Skype, the internet telephone company. When eBay acquired it, also in 2006, it had already signed up 53 million users, more than twice the number of phone customers served by venerable British Telecom. Yet Skype employed just 200 people, about 90,000 fewer than British Telecom had in the United Kingdom alone. One last example, Craigslist, the online classified ad site. By the end of 2006, it was serving up 5 billion pages to 10 million visitors every month. Yet it was being run by just 22 people. These companies can grow so large with so few employees because they're built almost entirely of software code running on the net. Such radical automation can be a boon to consumers. What used to be expensive, international phone calls say, can now often be had for free. But there's a dark side to their robotic efficiency. Each of these companies competes, after all, with old line firms that employ and pay decent wages to many people. YouTube fights for viewers with media companies. Skype battles telcos for callers. Many of the ads that run on Craigslist would have otherwise appeared in local newspapers. Past technological revolutions created a lot more jobs than they destroyed. But that doesn't seem to be happening with computerization. And if companies like YouTube, Skype, and Craigslist are any indication, a lot more jobs may soon be at risk.
Nicholas Carr's new book is The Big Switch, Rewiring the World from Edison to Google. He's also the former executive editor of the Harvard Business Review. Do you work in new media? Tell us about it at marketplace.org. Click on Contact. Coming up, lessons for the new working woman in Iran.
I want to send you downstairs, I said. You won't put your head down. You raise your head and look men in the eyes.
But first, let's do the numbers. A strong fourth quarter forecast from IBM sent the bulls running today on Wall Street, sparking a nice rally. The Dow moved up 171 points, 1.3%, to close at 12,778. The Nasdaq gained 38 points, 1.5%, to end at 2478. The S&P 500 added 15 points, or a little more than 1%, to finish at 1416. Big Blue's announcement pushed the computer giant's stock up more than 5%. Investors are expecting a bushel of good news from Apple tomorrow when the Macworld conference kicks off. Its stock climbed more than 3.5%. Overseas markets were mixed. Britain's FTSE gained 0.2%. The French CAC 40 jumped 0.6%. And bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note slipped to 3.78%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Grant Thornton, dedicated to serving their clients worldwide with a passion for the business of accounting. On the web at grantthornton.com. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by Society for Human Resource Management. Online at shrm.org. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases the December retail sales report. The House Oversight and Government Reform Committee holds the first of two hearings on steroid use in Major League Baseball. And it's the anniversary of the first Super Bowl, played on January 15, 1967. The Green Bay Packers beat the Kansas City Chiefs in Los Angeles. Still goes good with chips and guacamole. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund in for Kai Rizdal. President Bush flew to Saudi Arabia today on the latest leg of his Middle East tour. He arrived in the capital bearing gifts, including a multi-billion-dollar arms deal intended to counter Iran's military clout. The administration announced plans last year to sell $20 billion worth of U.S. arms to the Saudis and other allies in the Gulf. Saudi Arabia's portion of that includes sophisticated bomb delivery technology known as JDAMs, Joint Direct Attack Munitions. Joining us with more on this is our correspondent in London, Stephen Beard. He recently returned from a reporting trip to the region. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Tess.
So tell us about this deal. We've heard some of the basics. What lies behind it?
Well, this deal stems from a military assistance agreement that the U.S. signed last year with Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states. It needs congressional approval, and there's been some disquiet in Congress that in this deal there are some high-tech weapons which could be used to target Israel.
Right.
The White House, however, says this deal is a very important way for the U.S. to beef up the defenses of American allies in the Gulf against the enemy on the opposite side of the Gulf, the ever-resurgent Iran.
How has the president's anti-Iran message been going down throughout the Gulf? Because, you know, Gulf states like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, have been getting closer, actually, politically and economically, to Iran.
That's right. And this must indeed irritate the White House no end. Relations between Iran and its Gulf neighbors have definitely been improving. Last month, the Iranians were, for the first time ever, invited to a meeting of the Gulf Cooperation Council. This is the group of six Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, United Arab Emirates, and so on. Mm-hmm. And they were invited into this closed-door meeting to discuss Iran's suggestion for a free trade agreement between the Gulf Arab countries and Iran as a way of undermining American influence. Now, no decisions have been made on that. The Gulf states certainly don't want to upset the US, which is by far their most important ally, but they want to keep Iran sweet too, as it is a major economic and political force in the region, with influence extending well beyond its borders. So these Gulf Arab states are walking a tightrope between the two sides.
Yeah, really looking to play both sides of that coin, huh?
Yeah.
There is, however, some economic friction between these Gulf states and the U.S., isn't there? I mean, we've all been looking and watching the decline of the dollar, and that's been causing some problems.
It certainly has, because many of these states, I mean, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Oman, Qatar, Bahrain, they have pegged their currencies to the dollar. In good times, this was a source of stability for them. But as the dollar has declined, this has dragged down the value of their currencies. It's made it more expensive for them to import goods, and they really do import big time. They don't make many things in this region, so they're very big importers. This has fueled a great deal of inflation in this region, causing a lot of problems. I mean, UAE, for example, it's got near 10% inflation at the moment. So pressure is building to sever that link between these currencies and the dollar. But the fear is that if you get major oil-producing countries like Saudi Arabia severing the link with the US dollar, that could really knock international confidence in the greenback. There could be a dollar rout, a huge plunge, possibly tipping the U.S. economy into a pretty steep recession. That really would upset the Americans. So the Saudis are saying, no, the dollar link remains for the time being, but it is causing problems.
Yeah, on top of all the other factors that could be contributing to a possible recession in this country.
Indeed.
All right. Marketplace's Stephen Beer joining us from London. Thanks so much.
Okay, Tess.
Even as Iran's presence grows in that region, Iranians themselves are restless. Since the Islamic Revolution in 1979, fundamentalist Shiite Muslim clerics set the strict tone for government and public life. But inside people's homes and businesses, the scene is quite different. Borzi Dereghahi is the Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, and he brings us the tale of two women who came from very different religious backgrounds and used those differences to stitch together a business.
A wealthy woman in her late 50s, Sudaveh once had an elite post with a state-owned bank. But like many women in her class who led a secular lifestyle, her job was swept away by the Islamic Revolution. So she started a children's clothing factory. It was rare for a woman to run a business. The morality police promptly visited. She didn't know how to respond. Zarir, in her 40s, was her young assistant from the pious slums of South Tehran. She knew exactly what to do.
You have to answer them quickly. If they say, why are you wearing makeup? You say, I don't wear makeup for men. If they say, your socks are too thin, you say, but my hijab is long.
Sudaveh, who favors tight designer jeans and open-toe high-heel pumps, found the help indispensable.
I didn't even know how to wear my hijab. I had no one in my family teach me how. Not even my grandmother wore hijab.
Sudaveh also ran into numerous other hassles in the male-dominated business world.
At first, work was very hard. The stores would try to rip us off. They thought I was some simple rich woman whose husband was letting her do this just to keep her busy. I had to show them that I knew what I was doing.
Zarir came from a strictly religious family. At 16, she was married off, but her husband was abusive and divorced her. He won custody of their two children and refused to let her see her son and daughter. with no means to look after herself. She persuaded her father to let her leave the house and look for a job. That's when she met Sudanvin. It was the late 1980s.
When I came here, I was in a really bad state.
Sudove soon learned Zarir's story and gave her some sophisticated uptown advice. Discreetly befriend her ex-husband's new wife and offer to take care of the children now and then. It worked. Soon, Zarir and the second wife were conspiring, getting her the time with her children that had been denied by their father and the Islamic courts. Sudave hired more women, who now total 12 of her 40 employees. And there were other male-female headaches. Women wouldn't even look at the man and shrieked if they came too close to touching. If a woman wanted to hand some needlework she'd done to a man assembling shirts, she'd find Sudave to do it. This had to stop. It was hurting the bottom line. One day, some years ago, Sudave gathered all the women working in the factory's upstairs rooms.
I want to send you downstairs, I said. You won't put your head down. You raise your head and look men in the eyes.
Now they work together, listening to Iranian pop music while parakeets chirp in the background.
Now they're so normal with each other. It's like nothing. No one quit. They got used to it.
As the years went by, Iranian society continued to change. People began moving from villages and farms to big cities, cramming into tiny apartments. They had fewer kids and began doting on them with pricey clothes. 7 years ago, Sudave opened her own shop with her own brand. The company has since expanded to about a dozen stores nationwide. It generates millions of dollars in annual revenue. Recently, Zarir's father fell ill and was in a hospital. She went to visit him and sat by his bed. A business associate came in and he introduced her. "This is my daughter," he said with pride, "the one who works." In Tehran, I'm Borzu Deragahi for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, if you're not worried yet about America's infrastructure, you can officially start freaking out. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has ordered an end to all asphalt shipments to the U.S. He says he needs to keep it in country. Venezuela is one of the biggest exporters of asphalt bound for American shores. The move may violate a supply contract with the San Antonio-based New Star Energy. Chavez says if asphalt companies don't comply with the export restrictions, he may nationalize them. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 171 points, 1.3%. The Nasdaq kicked up 38 points, 1.5%. And the S&P 500 jumped 15 points. That's 1%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time, Chinese businessmen aren't mixing with the locals in Lesotho.
The Chinese, they must go back home, back to China. We don't want Chinese here.
I'm Tess Viglund. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.